Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Jennifer Swigert here on behalf of the appellant, Derek Thomas. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Proceed.
Mr. Thomas was pulled over late at night by five police officers. He was handcuffed, placed in the back of a patrol car, and questioned about his connection with a house that police suspected a gang was using to stash large amounts of firearms and illegal substances. He remained detained while the home was searched and was later booked into jail. Because he was not advised of his Miranda rights before the questioning, the court erred in admitting his statements, and his convictions for possession of the one firearm and the small amount of cocaine that were ultimately found in the home must be reversed.
How much time elapsed between when he was first pulled over and when the questioning began?
It's hard to tell from the record, Your Honor. Officer Grabsky testified that it was about 10:30 when he called the officers to say, I want you to pull this guy over. And then sometime shortly thereafter, Officer Grabsky arrived at the location where the Tacoma police and Pierce County Sheriff had pulled over Mr. Thomas. And by the time Officer Grabsky arrived, Mr. Thomas was already handcuffed and isolated in the back of the patrol car.
Was it at least 10 to 15 minutes? That's what the briefing seems to suggest.
I believe it was about 10 to 15 minutes, but there's nothing definitive in the record.
10 to 15 minutes between when he was pulled over and when the questioning began?
Or 10 to
15 minutes before he was taken to the home?
I believe 10 to 15 minutes before he was taken to the home. It could have been
We would evaluate whether he was in custody based on when the questioning began, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So what's the evidence that you're asking us to evaluate if you don't know what the evidence is?
The evidence is, that I'm asking the court to evaluate is the police-dominated atmosphere that demonstrates that he was in custody.
Well, but Heritage says that Terry stops aren't custody. So that's what the Supreme Court has told us. How does this differ? How does this differ from a simple Terry stop?
This is not a Terry stop because there was no indication that this was just going to be a brief detention for purposes of determining whether he lived at this home.
Well, what do you mean an indication? An indication to who?
To Mr. Thomas.
Well, all he would know is that he was pulled over and he admitted that he was driving while his license was suspended in the third degree. He's an experienced criminal. He would know that's not a very big deal and it wouldn't likely result in him being taken to jail.
But he also knew that there were five police officers here in the immediate vicinity from two different agencies, the Tacoma Police and the Pierce County Sheriff's, and that he was immediately handcuffed and put in the back of a patrol car, which he would then know was not something that would normally happen.
The standard is what a reasonable person would perceive, right?
Right.
And the U.S. Supreme Court says a reasonable person is an innocent person. So why would an innocent person perceive that they were in custody rather than just being subject to a Terry stop at the time the questioning began?
Because a Terry stop doesn't usually involve being handcuffed and being isolated. Heritage talks about those three factors, that the factor of just being handcuffed alone would not necessarily make this rise to beyond a Terry stop.
How about if he was pushed up against a wall and frisked? Would he be in not allowed to move away before he was questioned? Would that be in custody?
That would depend on whether the officers had reason to believe that he was armed and dangerous, which is the standard required.
Well, what I just prescribed you is what happened in Terry, which would be the ultimate Terry stop.
And they were and the court found that there was reason to believe that he was armed and dangerous.
Well, that's the standard for what it is. It doesn't describe what it is. It's the standard for having an allowable Terry stop.
But if
I'm trying to figure out what your theory is and how this differed from a Terry stop.
If the officers go beyond what would be permitted under Terry, and if there's no basis for the frisk, then that would go beyond what was permitted under Terry, then this is custodial detention.
Well, and what happened here that wouldn't be permitted under Terry?
He would not be permitted to be isolated in the patrol car in a police-dominated environment and placed in handcuffs with no sign that this detention was going to end, without any sort of a belief on the part of the officers that this was someone who was armed or dangerous or ready to flee. And for that, I would cite the court to State v. Cunningham, which talks about the fact that under certain circumstances, handcuffing, seclusion of the defendant, drawn guns might be appropriate. Under very extreme circumstances, all of that might be appropriate. But we don't have that kind of very extreme circumstances here. This is more than what would be permitted under Terry.
Does the fact that the CCO in this case had very strong suspicions that a crime, at least two crimes, had been committed, bear on this question?
Well, it does in the sense that that goes more to the interrogation, Your Honor, because of his strong suspicions, Officer Grabski was aware that his questions were likely to elicit incriminating information, which is the standard under Rhode Island v. Innes
so
for interrogation.
So bearing on the initial stop itself and the detention?
I don't believe it has any bearing on whether he was in custody, no. However, another reason why he was in custody is because when Officer Grabski arrived, this was not Mr. Thomas's usual community corrections officer who he was used to have checking up on him. So this was, again, yet another law enforcement officer that's suddenly involved. I see my time is short. I'd like to turn to the mandatory joinder issue briefly, if I may. Addition of the cocaine charge after Mr. Thomas had already been tried for unlawful possession of a firearm violated Criminal Rule 4.3.1's mandatory joinder provision because these were directly related offenses based on the same criminal conduct. The conduct that led to both of these convictions was the fact that Mr. Thomas was in dominion and control over the bedroom at 4840 South I Street on the night of July 14, 2012. Nothing more. That exact same conduct was used to convict him of both unlawful possession of a firearm.
Why didn't he waive that issue?
He didn't waive that issue, Your Honor, because there can't be a consolidation requirement when there's nothing to consolidate. There had been an amendment of the information roughly two months before. Apparently everyone forgot about it. Defense counsel remembered and informally contacted the prosecutor about it and said, hey, what about this other charge? And the prosecutor apparently talked to her and persuaded her that either the information had not been amended, and that was apparently verified by the clerk's error so that it didn't show up in the ECR. Or he convinced her that the state was simply not going to go forward on that charge. Under those circumstances, she would have had absolutely no motivation to say, hey, consolidate these. Why don't you charge my client with yet another felony?
You're saying that the prosecutor's representations misled defense counsel?
Yes, Your Honor, and perhaps not intentionally, but at best there was a lot of confusion here, and the burden of that confusion should not be laid on the defendant to solve.
But we don't have that in the record. I mean, we don't have those conversations in the record.
No, Your Honor, all we have is the hearing at which they discussed what happened and put on the record their recollections to the best of their ability. And so that's what they recalled happening. And there was no dispute from the state when counsel recited what she had been told and what she understood. So we would ask that the court reverse both felony charges because of the Miranda violation, and all of the charges because of the peremptory challenges. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Pierce County Deputy Prosecutor Jason Reif here on behalf of Respondent, State of Washington. I think the first point that's being missed in counsel's argument is that Mr. Thomas was not just a citizen with a full panoply of citizens' rights who was pulled over. He was a community custody inmate who was being monitored for community custody. DOC Community Custody Officer Grasby became aware specifically that he was living at an address that was not in compliance with his community custody conditions. That is not a crime. That is an administrative sanction, and that was the violation that he was initially investigating. That's the reason why he was watching the house, and ultimately it was when Mr. Thomas left the house that he had them initiate contact on the DWS 3.
What's the impact of that distinction on whether or not he was in custody as opposed to whether this was just simply a Terry stop?
Thank you, Your Honor. Two. One, the case law shows that probationers do not have a self-executing Fifth Amendment right when it comes to questions specifically germane to their community custody conditions. In this particular instance, we're talking about residents.
But they do when you're in custody. So the question is, are they in custody at this point?
The case law that I've read, Your Honor, says that they do not have a self-executing right when they come into the custody of their community corrections officer to be asked about things that are not likely to incriminate
them. The question here is, were they in custody of the police? I mean, he was seized here.
He was detained for both a CCO investigation, and there was an overlapping Tacoma Police Department Terry stop at the time.
So if he's seized, he could be in custody, and I think the key is what distinguishes this from being in custody and subject to interrogation.
I agree with Your Honor. I think that there is an overlay of analysis, though, because there are a chain of cases that talk about custody being a relative concept depending on the status of the individual. So when you look at, for instance, inmates in prison, they are necessarily in custody. If they're taken to an office and questioned, they are not considered to be at a level of custody for Miranda purposes that they need to be Mirandized. And so what we're dealing with here and the fine distinction is that what is custody for Mr. Thomas when he's dealing with community corrections officers supervising his conditions of community custody is different from a citizen who doesn't have any restrictions on his liberty, because we're talking about a reasonable person. And we're talking about Mr. Thomas's case, a reasonable community custody inmate who's in violation of the community custody conditions, both in terms of his residence and driving, who's being contacted by DOC.
So in this case, if the questions had been by one of the officers who detained him instead of the community custody officer, community corrections officer, that would have been a custodial interrogation requiring Miranda?
I would say no.
Because it's a correctional officer, no?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I would say no for two reasons. The first reason is we'd have to go through both analysis, so custody. And so we've been talking about what is the degree of custody that would apply to a community corrections inmate. Beyond that, I would say that under the Terry case law, he wasn't in custody for the purpose of Miranda. He was part of a Terry stop. He was being detained. The next part of the inquiry to trigger Miranda would be whether he was being asked questions likely to incriminate himself. And when you look at the record about what DOC Grassby did in the situation, he asked him, are you residing at 4080 South I Street? When Mr. Thomas said no, but I keep property there, at that point DOC Grassby terminated the contact and then went and conducted a compliance search.
How many questions were asked? You just related one. I thought there were three. Is there only one?
The record that I'm aware of in terms of the contact with Grassby that I could cite to the court is that specific question. If there are others, then I'm not aware of them. I know that at some point in the record it suggests that there was conversation about his driving status, but I don't know if that was with the officers before. So to the court's ultimate question about Miranda, I think that on the interrogation prong, we're going to look at, and there are cases here where the CCO, the person is in custody, and the CCO says, did you do it? Or are the guns yours? Here, Grassby asked about the residence. He didn't go a step further like the France case that defense cites, where he asked, so did you know you weren't supposed to be there because of a no-contact order, or are there guns and drugs in the residence that I'm going to find? His purpose of the contact was a administrative contact. He did not elicit information that was directly incriminating. It was coincidentally incriminating because ultimately they found contraband in the residence, and this would be close to the booking case where I cited, where you have information that's provided to a booking officer about a residence that ultimately provides dominion and control evidence in a case that comes up down the line.
Assume for the moment that we agreed with the appellant that he was in custody and should have been Mirandized. Is there sufficient evidence to sustain the charge here, or is that the end of it?
Okay, absolutely, Your Honor. I would say that there would need to be custody and interrogation to trigger Miranda. Beyond that, unquestionably, this would be harmless because we have, as to the evidence providing that he lived there, we have the earlier social contact with the officer, I believe it's Gutierrez, that happened a month before, where defendant, during a social contact, admitted to living there. Fast forward, in between the two trials, there were jail tapes that were admitted, and I can't quote them specifically, but where Mr. Thomas asked about the placement of contraband, talked about living there, and I'm not quoting that, but there is evidence that...
Would he have been in jail but for the fact that this was, you know, this was a driving stop and the statements he made in the search?
So if the court is asking if this is fruit of a poison tree type thing, and I would say that that issue wasn't raised as part of the briefing. If I had to respond to it now, I would say for the same reason that ultimately arrests do not get thrown out if you have other evidence of the crime. He was in custody. He was warned by the jail tapes that his telephone conversations were being recorded. He made it an independent act in a phone call. Yes, his placement there, but I guess we'd have to speculate whether those comments might have been overheard by other witnesses, if not by the jail recording. So because the fruit of the poison tree argument wasn't raised, I don't have anything more insightful to offer to the court on that. My intuition is that it wouldn't matter because of the intervening circumstances between the night of his arrest and when he's making a telephone call.
Unless the panel has more questions on this issue, would you turn to the joinder issue?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So, as my briefing indicated, first issue is a waiver in this case. They had pre-trial awareness of the existence of this charge at least by October of 2012.
And the trial was months later, a couple months later. Is that right?
Correct. The two trials. So the information where this UPCS count was added and then ultimately got misfiled extraordinarily by the clerk's office, where the parties didn't even get notice of what happened to it until June, approximately 6 months after trial, that information count was filed on October 2012. The first trial happened in December 2012. After there was the mistrial, the second trial happened in January of 2013. And ultimately, that case was called on the 24th, but the clerk's office didn't get around to filing that missing information until the 25th. So the parties were already underway on the corrected information at that time.
Was he tried on the information that went missing upon it being found, or was a new document?
A new document was entered, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
No, that's
okay. So, I mean, first of all, there's a waiver because counsel had pre-trial notice of this other count's existence, and counsel in the record says, I was shocked that the prosecutor didn't go forward with it. There are many strategic reasons why she wouldn't want the two to be tried together. I have those listed in a footnote of the brief. Beyond that, what we're talking about is a permissive joinder situation because it is not the same act as counsel proposes. I have a case cited in there where you talk about a UPCS inside a vehicle that's eluding a police officer. Clearly, the person has dominion and control over both the vehicle and the marijuana, but it is a separate act to elude a police officer in a vehicle.
So your backup argument is this is only permissive and not mandatory?
Correct, Your Honor. So it's waiver, and that the rule isn't even applicable to this case because, in this instance, possessing a firearm is a different act than possessing marijuana or cocaine, different act from violating a protection order and also driving without a license. In this particular case, it was just coincidence that all these things were found at the same time, which is exactly the same course of conduct scheme language that you see in the permissive joinder language that allows these things to either go forward together or not. And most often, defendants resist joinder because they argue that it's prejudicial.
Very quickly, can you address a misrepresentation? Was there a misrepresentation?
Your Honor, when I look at the record, to me, what I see is that this is something that was in June when they talk back to what happened and I think make a record about going forward. The prosecutor indicates that he is not going to go forward with the UPCS count at that trial. There was no promise or agreement that it was going to be indefinitely abandoned or that there was no evidence for it or something like that. It was just they were not going to proceed with it at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. We have 2 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to briefly address first the custody question and then the mandatory joinder issue. In State v. Cunningham, which is a Division III case from 2003, the court talked about the fact that cuffing handcuffing or secluding a person during a Terry stop has to be justified by concern that the person is dangerous or is likely to flee. Because that didn't happen here, this went beyond the scope of Terry and morphed into custodial interrogation because the officer was fully aware and, in fact, intended to elicit incriminating information relating to the suspected gang stash of weapons and drugs that then was ultimately not found at the house. The drug charges were improperly added in violation of mandatory joinder. These were related offenses. Unlike attempting to elude and possession of marijuana, there was no separate conduct here. It was purely possession. The only action that subjected him to criminal liability in either of these charges was possession, essentially dominion, constructive possession, just dominion and control over that bedroom on that night. State v. Kinsfogel talks about the fact that this distinction for when you have related offenses happens when you have close temporal and logical proximity. That's what you have here. And I would cite the court to State v. Carter, 56 Washington App 217, in which robbery and assault, also obviously sort of two separate types of conduct, were found to be related offenses. And, in fact, a defense counsel was found to be ineffective for not having objected under mandatory joinder. The ends of justice exception is reserved for truly extraordinary circumstances, which simply do not exist. Certainly, we hope it's unusual that the clerk would misplace a document, but that's not the type of unusual circumstances that in which courts have applied that, such as State v. Gamble, where State v. Andrus retroactively reversed hundreds of convictions years after the fact. So we would ask the court to reverse Mr. Thomas's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. The second matter.